And finally, I would like to introduce Clifford Lynch. Clifford's going to speak about research library collections and collecting in the 21st century. Thank you.
Well, it's nice to be here, and I'm particularly glad that I decided to work from notes rather than from PowerPoint, because given all of the wonderful stuff that has already been covered by my three colleagues and also some of the discussion that's been emerging, I am particularly grateful for the ability to be able to adjust my comments to cover a few extra things and return to a few points. We're here to really, I think, talk about the future of libraries and how they're evolving. I think that one, very, very clear theme that's emerged in all the talks, although maybe hasn't been said explicitly, is that that evolution is going to take place in a way that's integrally tied to the changing practices of scholarly work, be it in the humanities, the social sciences, the sciences, in professional fields of training. And that it's also going to be integrally tied to the ways in which scholarly communication are evolving. And we certainly have heard that as a theme that's, repeated and repeated. I think it's helpful to make a distinction, and I will come back later in my remarks to talk further about scholarly communication, between what we've seen happen over the last 20 years in mainstream scholarly communication, if you'll allow me the term, and the collection of things that are going under the rubric of digital scholarship. If you look at particularly the sciences, but increasingly the social sciences and some of the humanities as well, for example, the print journal is gone. Yes, it's still hanging on a little bit here and there. More and more journals are going electronic only because the print is simply an expensive encumbrance. We are growing more confident in our ability to preserve the electronic files for the long term. I mean, one of the reasons print hung on as long as it did was we had a exquisitely well-developed and expensive system for preserving print. And until we were able to, in some sense, gain the same level of confidence about our ability to preserve electronic files through a number of collective systems and technological developments, libraries quite responsibly weren't prepared to get rid of that print. But today, the print journal, most areas of science, many other areas, is on its last legs, and it's clear it's going. To the extent that print is still produced, a good example being when you join a scholarly society, you get the journal of that scholarly society. You have the option for print or electronic access. Typically, if you're affiliated with a university, the university, of course, has it in electronic form for the entire university community, setting up a problem, by the way, with the economic viability of scholarly societies, because a lot of people used to join them to get the journal and the convenience of having the journal sent to their home. Now, since they can get access to that journal anytime, anywhere, that convenience is a little less valuable. But you see the print being used much more as kind of, I'll skim this and toss it because I know I can always get the articles from the library. Now, the really striking thing about this, all of this migration, all of this investment to electronic form is this. If you could dredge up a scientist from the 1950s and showed them a printout or even what's on the screen from a journal article from one of those journals, they'd know exactly what they were looking at. They'd say, yeah, there are a couple of interesting, weird things here. There are some links you can click that take you to other things. But fundamentally, the discourse style laid out there, the template, the way ideas are developed, hasn't changed very much. Yeah, there's a little more color illustration, typesetting, if you run into connoisseurs of typesetting mathematics, has shifted a little bit, but really not much conceptual change. Now, the kinds of things, for example, that we saw Harriet show us a few examples of, start creeping towards genuine conceptual change. And indeed, scholars see these, and it's hard to know what to make of them. A lot of our sort of frame setting for these things don't work. I mean, just consider something as simple and trivial as this. A classical monograph, you know when you finished it. You've gone serially from beginning to end, and you know when you've looked at all the pages. Now, if I give you one of these large, complex, interactive database things where you can find your own pathways and connections, and particularly if I update it continuously, when have you finished with it? When have you looked at enough of it to do a review you're comfortable with? How do you test whether your students have absorbed it as part of their learning? We're really dealing, I think, with two classes of things here. One is things that we've taken electronically but not really conceptually revised very much, and then this whole new and fascinating outcropping of things that generally, that genuinely represent conceptual innovation in scholarly communication. And with this innovation, by the way, I'll just note, comes a lot of interesting problems. For example, because it's easy and helpful to integrate evidentiary and source material very extensively with many of these digital projects, you actually get a much greater intermixing of presentation of evidence and actual construction of argument. Whereas in a classical monograph, you might see short quotations, but you will see lots of references to archival material of various kinds, to other works. And so this is another one of these evaluative problems. Is there genuine new scholarship here? Or is there a lot of work which people will argue about the scholarly value of in terms of simply organizing and presenting evidence? And let me just underscore the argue there. There was a time in scholarship in many areas where people, I think, got a lot more credit for the preparation of critical editions than they do today. If you go over to the humanities, we see a strange debate which goes something like these quiet hall conversations. Well, he or she could actually have been a good biologist if they hadn't gotten sidetracked in building one of these little databases like GenBank or the Protein Data Bank that the entire field relies on to do its work. There's this whole question of the extent to which informatics is legitimate scholarship, or whether it's scholarship of a parallel sort or something else. This is not a totally new phenomenon. If you talk to people who do engineering on detectors in high energy physics, you know, there's this sort of, well, is it engineering or is it really physics? And you can't do the physics without it. We're seeing analogs of those arguments resurfacing in lots of complex ways. So I think I just wanted to spend a few minutes on that distinction because I think it's really critical. Now, let me note that library is a very slippery term that leads to all kinds of conversations that go past each other, because it refers to a physical place, it refers to a collection, and it also refers to an organization made up of people that sits within a bunch of larger social pacts and other sorts of things, and is profoundly connected with our strategies as societies for maintaining our memory and our record of what we did. When you look at, and when you think about it this way, you then see the surfacing of particularly horrible terms, the catchphrase of the late 80s and 90s, digital libraries, a term that, is oxymoronic in multiple ways, and still gives me a lot of agita when people ask me about them. Because it's one of these terms that's both resonant in a very helpful way of things that are important to us as a society, as scholars, but also very confusing in a lot of other ways. So let's talk about collections and how we deal with them, and that aspect of libraries, recognizing that that isn't the only aspect of libraries. So historically, research libraries have worried about two things, primarily. One is the scholarly record, with particular focus on the contributions that their faculty and their academic community have made to that scholarly record, and also reflecting the parts of that record that are of greatest interest to the local community. And that's a relatively constrained area. We've already talked about some of the inertia baked into it and some of the issues there. The other part of the collecting goals of research libraries, and here they begin to share common cause with many other memory organizations, museums, archives, national libraries, things that we don't really have great names for, but are have evolved in the 20th and 21st century to collect and manage certain kinds of audiovisual and digital material. But this is fundamentally a collection of evidence that can support future scholarship and the scholarship of today. This is something that's much broader and sort of infinite on its boundaries, that we sometimes allude to as the broader cultural record, of which the scholarly record comprises a fairly small part. And no institution can collect that by itself. In fact, there's a certain sense that all of the institutions operating collectively are fighting an eternally losing battle here. But that they're trying to make wise choices and good choices, and to kind of collectively build that up and hold it in trust for future scholars and researchers, and indeed other members of the society who are interested in that material. The rules are changing drastically in all areas here. If you look at that collection of broader cultural material, you can really kind of roughly subdivide it into two pieces. There's a piece that is commercially produced, if you will. It's intended for broad distribution into the society. This would include published books, music, movies, television broadcast, commercial computer games, on and on and on and on. Today it also includes sort of things like social media platforms that are used by an enormous amount of the population on an ongoing basis. Then there's the special collections, the one-of-a-kind things, the data sets, the hand-built objects, the personal unpublished papers. All of these things are terrifically important to research, and indeed, in some ways, they are the hallmarks of our great research libraries and the things that make one distinctive from the next. It is worth noting here that one of the things that's going very strange here right now, and we don't like to admit it, and indeed there are many people who are heavily invested in arguing this ain't true, but our ability to digitally capture physical artifacts is getting very good. It's getting good with 2D things, print pages, pictures, things like that. It's getting better and better with sort of 2D plus things. Think about painting where you've got a little bit of depth on the canvas, but it's sort of a 2D object plus a little. It's starting to get real good on a lot of 3D objects too. Sculptures, dinosaur bones, the built environment, cathedrals, country churches, very large sculptures, things of that nature. And, there is a whole school of philosophical argument that says these are no substitute for the original, for the physical original. But actually, we can make very good substitutes now for the physical original, and we're getting better at it at a fairly startling rate. I don't think it's going to be very long before we are at the point with a pretty large class of objects where we can produce copies of the original that are real hard to tell from the original, maybe almost impossible to tell from the original. In fact, if we are honest, in many cases, these digital, what shall we call them, versions, surrogates, representations, copies, are a lot better than the original, in the sense that you can use various forms of image enhancement. You can do things like go face-to-face with the fine details on the head of a 9-foot-tall sculpture, where they probably won't leave you in peace in whatever museum it lives in to set up a ladder and sit there for hours studying the thing. You can use multispectral enhancement, and that's been done to great effect in various kinds of manuscripts. One of the things we're learning is that physical and digital things have very different vulnerability profiles. They're both vulnerable, but as a matter of stewardship now, I would sure be more uneasy by the day sitting on a treasure house of physical objects that didn't have high-quality digital surrogates spread widely around the world, because stuff happens to physical collections. It's just, a sad record of history. Now, one of the byproducts of this means that the one-off physical things now, the constraints on replicating them and sharing them widely in a way that isn't tied to where they live physically is now much more a matter of intellectual property law and arrangements like that than it is a matter of technical issues. We've really kind of shifted the arena here. Now let's look a little bit at what happens as we move more deeply into the 21st century. And I think one of the things that we see emerging very clearly, and this again was a theme we heard from the other talks, is the need to deal with things collectively. For example, a lot of ensuring the digital preservation of publications of various kinds, particularly those where the scholarly sector is the primary consumer, like scholarly journals. This is best handled collectively. It's crazy for lots and lots of individuals to do it separately. Now, this doesn't mean that you want to necessarily indulge in the kind of engineering hubris that says, well, we know how to do this, so we're going to build one giant bunker somewhere, and that's going to be the preservation point for, you know, the scholarly and cultural record going forward, and we're all going to kick into the funding stream for that. Those things don't have a good record, monoculture is a very poisonous development when you're trying to preserve things. So you do want to spread it around some. You want to spread it around across national borders, across technologies, across different forms of governance and accountability and responsibility in different strategies. But it's still a approach that looks to more collaborative action, I think, than we've seen in the past. And we can see that rolling forward. There are other areas where I think we're just now starting to recognize that only by collaborative action can we deal with certain critical things. I'll just give you one example. Newspapers, journalism, the news, essential part of the cultural record, essential evidence for scholarship going forward. It's no accident that research libraries extensively have collected for a long time newspapers ranging from national newspapers of record all the way through very specialized local newspapers in various venues. Well, what's happening right now, other than a general implosion in the journalism marketplace, you know, just look at the number of newspapers today versus 20 years ago, is that the large successful ones aren't newspapers anymore. They're databases with very complicated interfaces. And yes, a few of them may still produce printed copies, but they are, you know, merely a poor shadow of what's in these databases. I can't imagine how we're going to deal with the preservation of journalism on a continuing basis without some kind of collective agreements with the key players here. And actually, I think, you know, again, we see this, and this came out a little bit in some of the conversations earlier, as the long-term responsibility for preservation of cultural record has fallen to memory organizations, to libraries, museums, archives. It doesn't sit with the producers of that material. The notion that publishers are going to, you know, preserve their output for hundreds of years seems very improbable. We're in a sort of a short-term state right now where they're being asked to, where we see journal publishers, for example, sitting on their archives. This seems very unstable, and it seems to be more and more unstable the farther you get from businesses whose primary revenue stream is the world of research, teaching and learning, the university community, the scholarly community. As long as you're in that closed cycle, you can exercise some considerable influence over their direction. You can make the point, people won't publish in your electronic venue if you can't tell them a credible story about how that's going to be archived and preserved in the long run. And you can't tell that story without the collaboration of the cultural memory organizations. Now, you go to a mass market publisher, their attitude is, we could care less. When it stops generating revenue, we stop worrying about it. Except maybe if somebody else finds a way to generate revenue, in which case we'll either license it to them or sue them. But it's not one of their priorities in most cases. So this is a very, very large challenge. Now, I also want to just say a few words about what do sort of fully articulated and elaborated research collections hold in the 21st century. It's very clear that they hold a lot of data. It's clear that in almost all fields of scholarship, data-intensive work is becoming more and more commonplace. It doesn't mean that's the only kind of scholarship being done, but that there is a significant amount that relies on large collections of data that need to be reused, recombined, revisited in order to validate and replicate research and build upon research that's been done. Those come from and are an integral part of the work of our faculty at our research institutions. They come, by the way, with a messy intertwining with software that's used to interpret them, and we could talk a long time about that. These are not going to be managed solely by universities. Science agencies are going to build repositories. We're going to see various kinds of disciplinary activity. It's going to be, I think, a very complicated patchwork. But at some level, I can't help but feel that, especially given the somewhat fickle nature of government funding to science agencies, that the ultimate responsibility for a lot of this material in the long term is going to fall to the cultural memory institutions, and particularly the universities. Evidentiary collections, observation of all kind, that example of the news, but also things that we just don't think about. For example, every major urban center now is creating vast amounts of sensor data that tells you a lot about what was going on in that city, how people are living, how they're moving, how they're conducting their lives. Who's going to preserve that? Do we need to preserve it? That's unquestionably evidence that can drive some fascinating scholarly work today or in the future. There's been an enormous rise of what I would call sort of non-commercial or non-mass market consumer goods that are a very interesting part of the cultural record. And even some that are mass market. One of the things we've had going for us for the last few centuries that's really interesting is that when the official cultural memory sector messes up and doesn't identify some new genre that's becoming important, often there's a generation of passionate individual collectors who do. And then over the course of the next generation or two, that rolls into the institutions as gifts or purchases as this material is recognized. Go back and look at the history of what we once called comic books or trashy paperback novels or things like that, all of which are now, recognized as important windows of insight into what was going on in various sectors of society. Various kinds of small-run musical recordings that represented certain kinds of ethnic communities or geographic communities' musical heritage. Now we've got, things like computer games, which are a huge economic sector, but we're still really uncomfortable about whether they belong in our libraries or how much, not to mention what to do with them. We're building various things that make it really hard to be a collector, various kinds of digital rights management, the notion that maybe you can't pass on your digital music collection to someone else when you're done with it, to your children or something like that. These are developments that are really putting the traditional collector safety net into some jeopardy. And non-commercial stuff is really hard to deal with. One of the wonderful things historically about the publishing industry was it packaged up rights and objects and sent libraries nice catalogs of these things to choose from. Now we face a time where libraries need to completely turn this around. They need to look for what's important, go out, negotiate, and attempt to clear rights, to build collections. And they need to do this both individually and collectively. They're going to need to do this with a lot of the outpourings of material that are going across the net, self-published material, in all, you know, artistic and creative genres, commercial records, all of that. So I think that these are things that are going to characterize a very different kind of collection building that is going to be essential to the libraries of the 21st century. And you've already heard some bits and pieces of it. Now, I could go on a lot longer about this, really I could, but I want to wind down and allow some time for questions. So I just want to close with two comments. One ties back to what Harriet in particular was highlighting about these new forms of scholarly discourse, and I think that certainly one issue with this innovation is just our discomfort about how to evaluate it and deal with it, the sort of examples I was giving earlier. The other, though, is its fragility from a preservation point of view. It's very hard to take seriously scholarship that's going to evaporate in 10 years, not leaving a trace, at least at some level. It doesn't feel like scholarship if it doesn't have some permanence of expression, perhaps. Here, I think we're going to increasingly, if we're going to deal with this material, have to see libraries falling into archival roles that's going to involve working closely with the producers of this. Now, whether you put a press in the middle or not doesn't make much difference. I think people will do different things. But I personally feel that one of the, you know, sort of great underminers of innovation in scholarly communication is that we haven't made sufficiently firm commitments or been clear enough about what we are and are not capable of archiving for the long run. The last thing I'll say, and I think what I will do is hark back to that comment about Vint Cerf and the Digital Dark Age. I was actually there when he gave that talk. He gave it at the AAAS meeting, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, in San Jose a couple of months ago, and he had clearly worked up a full court press release, interviews, pre-priming some journalists on this. And yes, it's absolutely true that to those of us who spent the last, 20 or 30 years worrying about this, that there was a certain naivete to this, and that some of it was grimmer than he realized, and some of it was a lot less grim than he realized. But the thing that was really important and helpful about that, and that we need more of, is that our ability to maintain the cultural record in the long term, particularly in this digital world, is as much about social will as it is anything else, including funding. Funding is a problem, but we do not have the legal clearances for our memory organizations to do what they need to do in many cases. And even beyond that, we don't have a sort of a social consensus that it's important that those institutions be able to do that. And I think seeing people, particularly people with the, you know, kind of prestige and credibility of Vint Cerf, speaking out about this is very helpful in terms of getting this on the broader public agenda so that we can achieve some kind of balance with the proprietary interests that allow us to preserve a memory. So that's sort of a look at collection building in the 21st century and how that fits in the broader context. And I think it is going to be vital for research libraries to recognize, as we see all of this digital convergence, particularly, that they are part of a broader context here, and that they are going to need to form alliances and collaborations, not just with other colleagues in the research library community, but substantially beyond that, in order to ensure that particularly the evidentiary material is there to do scholarship, not just later in the 21st century, but maybe even in the 22nd century. Thanks.
Thank you, Cliff. That was great. And we have a few questions. Thank you.
Hi. Thank you, Dr. Lynch. That was really an interesting talk. I thought that was fascinating. My question really just goes back to get your thoughts on the whole e versus print when we're developing our collections, because I think this is something that all librarians are always struggling with, especially because there's so much information coming out about and research about how folks are interacting with print versus e and collections lasting in digital formats or print formats. And we all want to do best by our users, and we want to be good stewards of that money. And so so every day, whether we're developing approval plans or making individual selections, we're not sure what to do. And I thought it was interesting when Dr. Burg said, you know, what's the question? I mean, I'm paraphrasing here, but, you know, what's the healthy balance between the two? And I think she said it depends, and I don't know, or I don't know, it depends, which I thought was great because it all depends, you know, every time we're doing this. So really what I'm wondering about is, like, I've seen research recently, I don't know if the citation, that folks learn better, or undergraduates are learning better with print, or that they actually prefer print. And then I've seen other research saying the opposite. And then we know the pros of electronic resources, the access, the space issues we have, all that a demand for learning spaces in universities. So we're grappling, when we care about all these things, we're grappling with all of that, you know, when we make those decisions. So I was just wondering what you thought librarians and libraries should be thinking about when we make those important decisions. I know there's disciplinary differences right across the board, but okay. We make those decisions about collection program, collection development approval plans and individual selections versus print, e, or both.
So this is an area that's a moving target, to be sure. And let me just give you a couple of sort of principles. One that we can't lose sight on, and this is probably going to occur first in mass markets rather than scholarly markets, but maybe not, is we cannot assume that because it's not available in print, it isn't important. That is a disastrous assumption at this point, and there are going to be situations where we have to acquire things in digital form because that's the only form we can get them in. And we're going to have to do it, you know, with our air sickness bag in hand as we deal with some of the licensing issues around it that don't apply to printed things. There's just no getting around that. In fact, one of the things that, you know, I'm very grateful for right now is that most significant stuff, particularly in the mass markets, appears in both print and electronic form, so libraries can acquire the print and then do the sorts of things they want to do as libraries. We're starting to see more and more material show up in electronic-only form. Right now, a lot of it is fiction. A lot of it is stuff like indie music. But these come with license terms on it that basically say, oh, if you're any kind of library or archival organization, forget it. We won't license it to you. We won't let you use it in any of the ways you need to use it. Just forget it. That is a massive disaster in the making in terms of cultural record. And there are people now that are doing some very disturbing studies about, you know, how the sort of standard arrangements through Amazon or iTunes or things like that affect libraries' abilities to operate. and there's lots more detail there by specific field. I think in terms of scholarly monographs, there is a very strong body of evidence that says that people who want to make intensive use of those and go read them, you know, cover to cover and really consider an extended argument that's being laid out, are generally happier doing that in print. It's easier to navigate. It's easier to navigate around to the footnotes, to annotate. Print is still really good for that. They would also often, though, like an electronic version of it, particularly if it's not at a lot of additional cost, because when you're trying to go back to the work and you're remembering a passage that said something, or you're just looking to pull out, you know, right now there's a lot of very important stuff that is hard to pull out granularly from these very lengthy discussions. And it seems very clear that as we go to databases of full-text searchable scholarly monographs, that there's going to be a whole sort of second market in people discovering passages or a few phrases or paragraphs by full-text searching, and that's going to be an important use of those resources that up till now has been underserved. So I would say for most of the scholarly monographic stuff, you probably want to go both. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean, by the way, that you need a hard copy on your shelves. You may want to go for the monographs a little bit like you're handling journals, where if somebody really wants to do a full, you know, transversal of that monograph, they do a print-on-demand on it, just like people still, when they want to do intensive study of a journal article, often print it. I'll say just one more thing about this, because we really could go on this one all day. There's a set of issues about textbooks and learning. And here the issues are not just technical, they are ethical. And we are doing just the worst job imaginable of addressing these. You are seeing now people promoting these learning, these electronic textbooks with learning reader analytics. And those tie into broader learning analytics that come out of your grading systems and your learning management system. Basically, this is a book that tattles on you to your professor and says when you read it and how much you read it and whether you went back and read the review section and whether you're prepared for class. I have actually heard these sort of glorious portrayals of faculty member, imagine this technological paradise. You come into your class, you pull up your dashboard. So your dashboard has all your students on it. And it will tell you which of those students have read the assignment and when. So you can decide who to call on and whether to do a pop quiz. This sort of stuff makes me very, very queasy. And, irrelevant almost of the of the particular studies about do you absorb better or not, I'm really scared about going all electronic on textbooks till we get some of these ethical issues sorted through.
Thank you for your answer. And I should have said my name is Robin Canuel, and I work as a librarian at the Humanities and Social Sciences Library. So it is a complex issue because I've heard million permutations of what I should be doing and how we should do it, and it's complicated, so.
It is.
Thank you.
Sorry to keep you so long.
No, it's fine. My name is Marisa Rucco. I'm an MLIS candidate. I am an ex-humanist and also a student librarian in an engineering library at Polytechnique. So my dual identities have a question for you, or for anyone in the panel. What role do bibliometrics play in either collection development or feeding your repository? If it's so contrasting between the sciences and the humanities with the different tools, so I'd like to know what your take is on that.
That's a hard question. I get myself into a lot of trouble here.
I know I said a bad word, but...
So let me start by saying I think bibliometrics are one of these sort of, you know, fascinating retrospective analytic tools that can tell you things about how knowledge diffused and who built on who. And it's very clear that the systematic use of these for those purposes has opened up some very useful new windows into the sociology of knowledge and this kind of thing. When you start seeing people using bibliometrics for predictive or evaluative purposes, I start getting very nervous. It has been remarkable and to me really scary the extent to which some institutions now are including bibliometric analysis as part of tenure and promotion processes rather than trying to actually make some effort to evaluate the scholarship itself. And, you know, it's particularly delightful when you see them using it in various sort of voodoo-like ways where you, you know, inherit the journal impact factor onto a random article that appeared in the journal, for example. I always loved that one. So I think they need to be used with caution in collection development, which kind of sits somewhere between that, you know, very analytic kind of scholarly view and the predictive and evaluative kinds of uses they're being put to. Certainly, it's reasonable to think that things that are getting a lot of attention probably belong in your collection someplace, just by virtue of the fact that that many minds interacted with it or quoted from it or cited it. But I think that the converse is not true. Just because you have things that aren't being cited much doesn't mean they're not important.
And disciplines that lack this analysis. So
yeah, I am also very uneasy with the current some of the current practices around. Well, you have a good repository because it's got articles in it that are retrieved or linked to a lot. Taking that on really demands that you are clear about why you're building the repository in the first place and what's supposed to be in it and what your time horizon is. But I think that people are being a little glib about bibliometric analysis in that area as well.
Thank you.
I've probably gone way past my time. Thank you.
Join me in thanking you.